This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to New York, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Okay, welcome everybody. Sorry about that. We ran into a little technical difficulty there, but we're not doing bad, only a few minutes late. We do have our guests here tonight. I want to welcome everyone here on Pell Talk as well as listening on the radio. Our guests this evening, by the way, my name is Charles Giuliani. I'll be the host this evening. Our guests are Professor James Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, as well as Dr. Greg Jenkins of Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. In case you're not familiar with what's been going on in the 9/11 Truth movement, Professor Fetzer founded the original group Scholars for 9/11 Truth, whereas in the past year there's been kind of a disagreement among the members, and therefore we now have Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, which is the group that Greg Jenkins now represents. Essentially, both are in agreement. Both schools of thought are in agreement that the Twin Towers were taken down with explosives, you know, through a controlled demolition. Essentially, the difference is over how this was done. But I'll save those details for our guests. We're hoping that this isn't going to be a debate as far as arguing back and forth. This has been a big point of contention, but hopefully we won't have contention here tonight. We just want to get different sides and, you know, let people decide for themselves. So why don't we begin with, I guess we'll begin with you, Dr. Fetzer. Maybe you can give us a little background about the Scholars of 9/11 Truth movement itself and what has gone on. I'm sure a lot of people want to know, you know, exactly how this came about, and
sure.
You can just give us a little detail on that.
Sure. Well, when I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth a year ago, December, I invited Steve Jones to be my co-chair. And we had a pretty amicable relationship for most of the year. I think by June, however, I had become reasonably convinced that Thermite and Thermate couldn't provide the whole story of what happened to the Twin Towers. And I emphasized all the arguments we have against the government.
Excuse me one minute, Dr. Fetzer. I kind of lost your sound. You were coming in clear, and now you've dropped in volume. I can hardly hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's a little better, yeah.
There's some beeping going on with my phone, which...
Are you on a cordless?
No, I got a new digital.
Beeping, huh?
Yeah, but look... So by June, I began emphasizing more and more, you know, the discrepancies in the melting point of steel and the hottest temperature that a jet-based fire can attain, that Underwriters Laboratory had certified the steel up to 2,000 degrees for 3 to 4 hours, and that the fires were actually only burning around 500 degrees by virtually all sides, with a couple of scattered pockets of 1,300 or 1,400 degrees. So it's pretty obvious that the steel hadn't weakened, much less melted. In fact, back on 13th of February 1975, there was a huge fire in the North Tower on the 11th floor. It consumed three-quarters or 65% of the floor. It burned at 2,000 degrees for some 3 hours, a much more intense fire. And yet none of the trusses, none of the steel beams that connected the core columns to the external peripheral 240 columns had to be replaced. So although we can't run an instant replay on the Twin Towers, it's very obvious that the steel didn't weaken, much less melt. And, of course, if it had, the pattern of destruction would have been enormously different. It would have sagged, tilted, been very gradual, and probably would have been unable to go anywhere. I mean, remember, all those towers were designed to support everything above them, and the vast majority of the building was stone-cold steel. I like to draw the metaphor of the Eiffel Tower, because, of course, the steel in the Twin Towers was about 4 inches thick at the base, tapering off to a quarter inch at the top. very analogous in the sense of being far more massive in its support at the base than at the top with the Eiffel Tower. No one would ever imagine that if there were a plane that hit the top of the Eiffel Tower or some fire had broken out, that the tower would collapse.
Right.
What actually happens is, in fact, rather astonishing, because we have the destruction of these buildings basically from the top down, while with the South Tower, of course, these 30 floors tilt over and then turn to powder, as even Steve Jones has recognized in his paper published now in the Peter Dale Scott and David Ray Griffin book, 9/11 and American Empire, which is an astonishing phenomenon, but tends to accompany the inference that Judy Wood has drawn, that these buildings are turning to powder. They're being pulverized from the top down. She draws the comparison with two gigantic trees that are turning to sawdust from the top down. And, of course, they disappear in roughly 10 seconds apiece. And what's odd about it, of course, is anyone who would want to claim that they collapse, they'd have to be collapsing through the path of most resistance, which, of course, is absurd from the point of view of physics. Now, Steve's views about thermite and thermate seem to me to be, interesting for parts of the tower, but it seems to me can't possibly be the whole explanation because the devastation is so massive. And by the end of December, I think that I, in particular, during an interview I had with Judy on the 11th of November, she had invited my attention to a website she'd constructed with Morgan, where they laid out a huge photographic array of the extensiveness of the destruction to the entire World Trade Center and these so-called toasted cars. And I was and the fact that the bathtub, this foundation in which the World Trade Center was constructed, was not functionally incapacitated, which seemed highly improbable if the full weight of those 500,000-ton buildings had collapsed upon them. I mean, implausible to the extent that building six, when it's being brought down, although it's only eight floors, is being brought down by cable when they're cleaning things up because they don't want to damage the foundation. Now, that tends to support the inference that the full mass of those buildings did not collapse on the bathtub. And in fact, when you look at the stack of rubble, it's really quite modest. It's approximately at ground level, so that you have, some debris filling the sub-basement levels, but not really above the ground level. And that seems to me to be very inconsistent with a thesis that would claim that thermite or thermate was the principal cause, because they are cutter charges that would leave the rest of the collapse up to gravity, and in fact the buildings are coming down faster than they could have come down under gravitational traction alone. So,
right.
In any case, I began, when I had Judy on, I featured her website as I would for any other guest I have on who has a website. And of course it was talking about a Star Wars beam weapon, which is the name she had given to it. And it's actually, of course, a Star Wars beam weapon hypothesis, or really better, a whole family of hypotheses, in the sense that she's introduced the idea that some sort of non-conventional high-tech weapon, some sort of directed energy weapon, had to have been involved to bring about this massive devastation, which on a multi-causational theory, which I tend to embrace, can have involved one kind of destruction in the sub-basement, the sort of thing Willie Rodriguez was talking about, which Gordon Ross and Craig Furlong has established was taking place in the Twin Towers as much as 14 or 17 seconds before the planes hit the building. And then perhaps thermite to initiate at the top and to complete, but in the middle 80% roughly, it looks as though the buildings were really pulverized, completely disintegrated. You're talking about all the concrete, that flooring was about 5 inches thick. The office furniture, the chairs, the desks, the computers, the human beings and other living things seem all to have been turned into very fine dust, which was indeed the ubiquitous phenomenon that accompanied this whole event, so that, lower Manhattan covered with dust.
Dr. Fetzer?
Yeah.
Yeah, if I could just interject for 1 second.
Sure.
We seem to be having some serious technical difficulties here. I don't know, Don, back in the studio, if you can hear me.
I can hear you.
Yeah, two problems. Number one, I can hardly hear Professor Fetzer. I really have to strain.
Thank you.
There's another problem, though. We're not getting sound in Pal Talk. They're just getting music. They can't hear the interview.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's no good.
Well, I running it through Pal Talk, we're not set up to do that yet. That's again, that was something we didn't do. We're just now setting up for Pal Talk. We've never ran it through Pal Talk before.
So you it's not going to happen tonight?
Charles, do you want to call me back?
Well, I don't know. I think someone's running it through Pal Talk. I would assume somebody is.
Well, I mean, you're obviously broadcasting, right, over the network, right?
Well, we're right now live, correct.
Okay, so I'm going to have to tell the person...
We're live. I mean, I don't know what we're... I know that they work with Pal Talk, but we are BBS Radio.
Well, they're saying they're hearing music right now. Let me see. I'll check the room and see if that's still the case. Oh, okay, wait a minute. Okay, they are picking it up now, so that's one problem alleviated. But now the next problem is there some way that you can boost the sound so I can hear?
Sure. Let's do a test. Greg?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, hold on.
Charles, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, a little low.
Okay, hold on, bear with me. Go ahead. Talk away. Greg?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, that's a little better.
Testing.
Yeah, that's much better.
Is that better?
Yeah. Professor, you want to start?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Yeah, that's a lot better. Yeah.
Excellent.
Okay, great.
Good. So anyhow, in early December, there was a group within the society was upset that I was even listing these links, which seemed to me to be a pretty neutral thing to do, but I was certainly endorsing the idea of looking at a broader range of hypotheses, and some of those, including Steve, preferred that sort of discussion ought to take place on the forum rather than be acknowledged, you know, in terms of the website. I thought that was a mistake. I mean, science is a fascinating venture. Trying to figure out what's going on here is one of the great mass murder mysteries of history. So I was disinclined to, you know, put it in the closet. And we just had this tension that led to Steve's resignation on the 5th of December and an attempt to, you know, conduct a vote by taking control of the website's email, or the society's email list, and conducting a vote using a fake administrator's name and a phony address to make it look as though it had come from the society. I found all this very, very bothersome, very upsetting, and things got worse from that point. I asked for Alex Flom, who had obtained the website domain names at my direction on behalf of the society, to return them to me, but instead he turned them over to Fred Burks, who played a rather limited role in relation to the history of the society. And Fred, on two occasions, froze the website, which led to my having to create a new website at 9/11 Scholars. And, of course, I mean, this rather deepened divisions between us. So.
Right.
I tend to describe it as differences in attitude toward the science and the politics of 9/11. And if anyone watched, you know, the exchange between us during the Scholars Forum out in Chandler, which is now, I think, fairly widely accessible, including on 911scholars.org, I think they'll get a good sense of the difference in our emphasis on the evidence and why I have a certain degree of skepticism about some of the evidence that Steve relies upon and why I think it's indispensable to broaden the range of hypotheses for consideration.
Right. Let me turn it over to Greg. For those who just joined us kind of late on Pal Talk, sorry again for the mix-up. We were talking here for about, 5-10 minutes, and they were just getting music. I didn't even realize. But anyway, let me turn things over to, for those that just joined us on Pal Talk, essentially what Professor Fetzer is saying is he believes that, and this has been the source of, you know, the major split with the 9/11 Scholars and 9/11 Truth Movement. His contention is that, again, both of them agree the towers were taken down with by demolition, no question. Professor Fetzer believes, though, that the demolition involved more than conventional explosives, that there was some powerful beam weapon and or mini nuke to account for the pulverization of the bulk of the contents of the building and the snapping of the steel. So now, if we can turn over to Dr. Greg Jenkins.
Thank you, Charles. It's good evening, and let's see. Well, I mean, who can deny that these buildings were brought down in a controlled demolition? I mean, if you look at the collapse of the North Tower, for instance, we've definitely seen that the antenna start to sink into the building first. I mean, this is in direct contradiction to the NIST report, which says that the exterior columns gave way first. So, I mean, you know, it's very strong evidence that the official story just does not hold any water. Furthermore, you have things like, you know, the pre-collapse explosions.
You know, but before you go on,
holes of metal in Building 7 and the two towers.
Dr. Jenkins?
Yes.
Did you see a correlation between that and the penthouse collapsing on Building 7 for us before the building itself came down?
Yeah, that's a very interesting topic. Now, I mean, there was a Scholars for Truth and Justice professor at Brigham Young University who actually did a calculation. Just using conservation of energy and conservation momentum and not factoring in the resistance of that building, this is Dr. Cutler's work, okay? He couldn't get that building to collapse any faster than 8.3 seconds, okay? That building came down in 6.5 seconds. And then you compare that to free fall and it's 6.0 seconds. So it's no wonder that the official report for Building 7 hasn't come out yet. I mean, they can't figure out how to describe this.
No resistance at all.
Okay. And so, I mean, you have other things, you know, like, you know, kind of more circumstantial evidence, which is actually very strong. I mean, you have the NORAD stand down. You have put options on American Airlines. You have all this foreknowledge from over 10 countries warning of the attack. I mean, the list just goes on and on. So it's really undeniable that this was an inside job. Now, I want to allay some worries that the listeners have that the scholars split. Now, there was a vote put out in early December to all the people on the list, all the members over via email, and the question posed was, do you want to belong to, you know, kind of Fetcher's group, which would be the scholars for 9/11 truth? Or do you want to only belong to the Scholars for Truth and Justice, the newly formed group, or do you want to belong to both? And the 57% of the members responded to that email, and only 5%, you know, decided to only endorse and be members of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, whereas over 80%. Okay, decided to join the new group and steam the old group, okay, which was basically, you know, Fetcher promoting what he just said. I mean, Fetcher was promoting kind of these you know, exotic weapons and this type of thing, and you had the scholars fleeing from that, okay? There was a mass exodus away from that. Now, 15% voted to be in both. So overall, you had a 95% enrollment in the Scholars for Truth and Justice. Okay, and so this was not anywhere near a split, okay? This was a wholesale rejection of Fetcher using the website as his personal blog, endorsing kind of these absurdist claims that for instance, most of the debris never hit the ground. I mean, I think I address it very well in my article that you can find on the Journal of 9/11 Studies. To where the sub-collapses, I mean, there were seven levels of sub-collapses within the, seven stories. There were six sub-levels. The bottom level was two stories tall. So effectively, you had seven stories of sub-levels all within the bathtub region.
And so that's where the bulk of the debris had landed, you're saying?
Right. And so at the footprint of the towers, you had total collapse directly beneath the footprint. Okay, and then you also had, you know, within the bathtub, other multiple collapses. Now, not all the areas in the bathtub collapsed, okay, but if you look at maps that was put out by the Muser engineering consultant, okay, and then the New York Times made a schematic diagram based upon their work, if you kind of use that as an estimate on what would be a plausible scenario to account for where the debris went, I mean, it makes perfect sense that most of the debris went into the sublevel collapses. Okay. Now, as far as the bathtub damage, I addressed that in my paper as well, as does James Gourley, who clearly shows that the bathtub walls had withstood 21 times since the building of the World Trade Center, earthquakes over 3.0 in Richter scale. Now, the largest Richter scale reading, I forget which tower it was from, but the largest Richter scale reading was 2.3, associated with one of the collapses of the towers, okay? And so it's just a natural consequence that you didn't have major damage to the bathtub wash, bathtub walls. So it's true, you didn't have catastrophic failure of the bathtub walls. You did have some damage, but, you know, it wasn't catastrophic. Now, one thing that they were very concerned with is because there was such damage to the sublevels, there was not much force buttressing the inside of the bathtub. And so, you know, they were very skittish about, you know, driving heavy equipment close to the walls and this type of thing during cleanup, okay? So, and also another kind of misconception that is hammered around within the 9/11 truth community is that the buildings were mostly pulverized to fine dust. This is just not the case. Stephen Jones actually received samples straight from Janet McKinley. It was an apartment right next to Ground Zero. And what he did is he actually filtered, you know, with a 1.3 millimeter filter. He filtered this dust, right? And so 75% by weight was greater than 1.3 millimeters associated with that dust. Okay, now it's true you did have some fine dust. There's no doubt about that. But to argue that most of the buildings were turned into dust is just, you know, it's off base. It's unfounded.
Well, there is the case, and we talked about this on the phone the other day, there is the case of the tremendous amount of dust, you know, 3 inches, 2 to 3 inches thick, covering all of lower Manhattan. Is it your contention that that's essentially just the cement flooring?
Yes, it is my contention, and it's backed up by the USGS dust samples. I mean, one thing that Woods and Stetzer, and Stetzer can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they endorse that a lot of the metal in the World Trade Center, a lot of the steel in the World Trade Center towers was turned into dust. But, you know, if you look at the ratio of, say, steel to concrete, it was 80% steel so 80 parts steel to 100 parts concrete, right? If you analyze the top 110 floors, that was the ratio of the mix, roughly. Well, in the dust samples, you only measure a 2% iron content, okay? So what that means is that there was virtually no iron in the dust because Stephen Jones actually measured the actual bulk samples from the McKinley samples. Dust samples. He looked at the bulk concrete. There were large chunks of concrete, and he did a chemical analysis on that, as well as a big chunk of wallboard. And if you look at the iron content in those two samples, it was only roughly 2% on average. I mean, two plus or minus half a percent, something like that. Okay.
I tell you what, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. And we'll be right back after these messages with our guests, Dr. Greg Jenkins and Dr. Jim Fetzer. Thank you. Okay, welcome back. Once again, my name is Charlie Giuliani. Our guests are Dr. Greg Jenkins and Professor James Fetzer. We're talking about the split in the Scholars for 9/11 Truth movement over what exactly caused the towers to collapse. Both sides agree, of course, that it was a controlled demolition, but there's a disagreement as to how that was actually done. I just want to mention that for our listeners on the radio, unfortunately, we're not set up this evening to take questions from listeners here in Pal Talk, but we are set up to take calls from our listeners on the radio. You can ask questions of our guests. Here in the U.S., you can call toll-free at 877-270-8714. Once again, that's 877-270-8714. Outside the U.S., you can call at 530-413-4515 or 530-413-4511. Okay, before the break, Dr. Jenkins, you were in the middle of a thought there. I hate to cut you off. So
oh, yeah, please. And one thing is you're very low. I can hardly hear you right now. But let me go ahead and continue. What I was saying is that the bulk concrete measured only roughly a 2% iron content. And that matches what the dust samples were taken at the, you know, in 12 different samples by USGS so it looks like no appreciable amount of steel, okay, and this is proof for it, no appreciable amount of steel was disassociated, you know, from the collapse. And so I don't really know why, how that's refuted or how you can refute that. But let's see. During the collapse, I mean, I go through my paper and analyze kind of the directed energy weapon scenario, okay? And I analyze all types of weapons that could possibly be used, okay, for the demolition sequence. And the energy scales associated with actually vaporizing an appreciable amount of steel. For instance, in my paper, I look at, you know, vaporizing 50% of the steel from both towers, okay? And when you do that, the power required in order to vaporize that amount of steel, okay, with no loss included, no, you're perfectly coupling all this energy directly into the steel, which is impossible, but if you say hypothetically you can do it, it's greater than 5 Earth worth of power. So you take the entire global output, including all carbon combustion, okay, all hydroelectric, all nuclear power, everything, fires in Zimbabwe, I mean, just everything you can imagine, and you're still left with, you got to pump in over 5 Earth worth of power to vaporize just 50% of the steel associated with the tower. Mm-hmm. Now, if you factor in any kind of loss mechanism, okay, that'll put you at thousands of Earths worth of power to vaporize any appreciable amount of steel. And then you don't see any steel in the dust. So I don't even know really why these guys are arguing in favor of you know, large amounts of dissociation of the steel.
You know, I
won't have a caller. Would you like me to put the caller on?
Actually, yeah, I guess we do have a caller.
Okay.
I guess we'll take this call at this time.
Okay. Sorry to interject quickly there. I couldn't, I was waiting a while.
no problem.
Okay, we'll put the caller on right away. Thank you.
Okay, welcome on the air. Could you give us your name and just your birth name and where you're calling in from?
I'm Jules, and I'm calling from Buffalo, New York.
Okay, I didn't catch the first name.
Jules?
Jules. Okay, what's your question for, is it both the guests or one or the other?
I kind of sort of have two, if you don't mind. The first thing is for those of us who lost somebody in 9/11, we're now to believe that it was actually an inside job. Is that what you guys are telling me? And my other question is this. I've been hearing a lot about a thing called thermite. And I was wondering if you guys could give me a little bit more insight and understanding on what is thermite. Because I'm being told by several people that thermite is the key to proving that it was an inside job.
All right, Professor Fester, did you want to
give me a little bit more understanding?
Sure.
Well, thermite is a kind of high temperature cutting charge that can cut through steel. It comes in a supplemental version called thermate, which is has sulfur as an accessory that reduces actually the temperature at which the steel is cut. If thermate or thermite were the key to it, then the buildings would be coming down basically by gravitational attraction alone, although Steve has suggested that some conventional explosives like RDX might have been involved here. So far as I have been able to discern, however, any gravitational collapse would be much, much slower than these buildings were actually blown apart. It's not even correct to describe it as a collapse because they're actually being pulverized, And it's the most distinctive feature if you take a look at the photographic record, which is quite stunning and massive in relation to the what's going on, the enormous amount of energy required for pulverization. So that if you want to go, let me suggest a website where you can find a whole photographic repertoire here that will give you some idea about this, which is at drjudywood.com, D-R-Judy, J-U-D-Y, Wood, W-O-O-D.com, where you can find a huge array of photographs recording this. But let me also say that if you just go on to 911scholars.org, that, and if you scroll down to 23-25 February, you'll see a Scholars Debate Jim Fetzer and Steve Jones video where a fellow who's not present here today but who's being represented by Greg Jenkins and I are exchanging views about the science of 9/11. It's my view that the class of conventional explosives to which Steve Jones and Greg Jenkins and others are committed is not sufficient. Not that it may not have been involved at the beginning, say, and at the end of these demolition scenarios, but that it's certainly not adequate to explain the virtually 80% roughly decimation of the building in between. If the buildings had actually come down just by conventional explosives, there'd be a mass of debris there, which is absent. The foundation, known as the bathtub, almost certainly would have been shattered. There would have been an enormous amount of flooding of the subways and the path train tunnels and underneath the foundations. The whole scenario would have been very different, and you can get a striking comparison, a test case. Everyone agrees that Building 7, which was a separate 47-story building, came down by a controlled demolition that occurred about 7 hours later, 5:20 in the afternoon. Photographs are now available of the rubble pile from Building 7, and they reach 5, 6, or 7 stories high. What that indicates is if the North and South Tower had actually been brought down by a controlled demolition using only conventional modes of demolition, the stack of debris should have been somewhere like 10 or 12 floors high, and it simply isn't there. It's not that it's all just disappeared into its sub-basement levels. The Building 7 had sub-basement levels too, and yet you can get a very nice contrast case of a bona fide classic controlled demolition in Building 7 with a massive pile of residue 5, 6, or 7 floors high, and the towers 1 and 2 were virtually, they're reduced to ground level. There's some very good photographs showing workers walking around, and it's virtually at ground level. So I say something more was involved than thermite or thermate. Now, as to your broader question about that this was an inside job, I'm sorry to tell you that the evidence we have, which is rather voluminous at this point in time, all points in that direction. There are many books I could recommend, but if you go to 911scholars.org, you'll find a whole list of them, especially some by David Ray Griffin are particularly good. One called The New Pearl Harbor is a good place to start. Another is entitled The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. My first contribution will appear in about a week or two. It's entitled The 9/11 Conspiracy, and it involves contributions from 10 or 12 scholars.
Yeah, we're getting a busy signal, John. There we go. Yeah, you know, for Jules or anyone else just tuning in, we are focusing tonight specifically on the collapse of the towers and how demolition was used to bring them down. But the whole 9/11 saga involves, you know, the problems with the official story involve far more than just the towers coming down. I mean, the whole thing, everything from who hijacked the plane.
Remember, Charles, one of the most important arguments for non-conventional modes of demolition is the massive destruction not just to the Twin Towers, but to Building 3, 4, 5, and 6, which
right.
are very odd features that, so far as I can see, are inexplicable on the thermite-thermate hypothesis, even if it were supplemented by something like RDX, which has a chemical residue that allows it to be identified and, to the best of my knowledge, has in fact never been identified as having been used there.
Right.
We do have a caller on line 2.
Okay, we have another caller.
Go
ahead, please. State your first name and where you're from, and then your question.
It takes me about 3 seconds.
Oh, I guess I don't have a line yet.
Yeah. 3 seconds.
Okay. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, could you state your first name, where you're calling from, and your question?
This is Steve from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
And okay.
I'm looking at maybe a different scenario, and not that I disagree with you. I think that everything you say is true, and I really appreciate your investigation of it. But I think it's a foregone conclusion that the Bush administration is conflicted because it delayed the investigation of all of this for 2 years. I mean, 5 days after Pearl Harbor, we had five different investigations going on, and George W. Bush fought hard to keep an investigation of 9/11 for 2 years. And I'll let go of the mic and listen to you in the room. Thank you.
Okay, I can address that.
Sure.
And actually, Steve brings up a very good point. I mean, they did nothing but put roadblocks up this investigation, all right? And it mainly emanated from Dick Cheney.
Okay, there we go. Go ahead.
And not only that, when the investigation actually occurred, what happened at the 9/11, they put Zelikow, okay, in charge of the information that would be fed to the commission. Now, Zelikow is known to have very deep ties with Condoleezza Rice. And so not only did they, you know, throw up all these roadblocks to stop the investigation wasn't even, you know, didn't even pretend to be independent, okay? So, I mean, you have many, many things associated with that investigation. I mean, the commission report, I agree with Spencer. David Ray Griffin did a very good job of meticulously going over what the investigation actually put out in their final report. And it was just a whitewash. I mean, the whole investigation appeared, was set up from beginning to end to whitewash the whole thing.
Well, it's a federal institution investigating the federal government. I mean, give me a break.
Right, but they didn't even mention Building 7.
Right.
Okay, didn't even appear in the 9/11 Commission report. I mean, it's absolutely absurd.
Well, the NIST report admits they did not examine any of the steel for explosive residues, and yet they insist there was none.
Right, and none of the investigations did that. I mean, the FEMA report didn't investigate, you know, any kind of explosive hypothesis, and the NIST report didn't touch it with a 10-foot pole either, okay? They didn't test for residues at all. But Stephen Jones did test for residues, okay? I mean, he actually got slag samples, okay? And for your listening audience, what a slag sample is, if you do any kind of welding or anything like that, what happens is as you melt the steel, you might have it drip over on the side, okay? So if you're going to use, like, thermite or thermate or, you know, RDX, or well, it probably wouldn't happen with RDX because it would cut so fast, but if you melt the steel, you're going to get these drippets, okay? And so that's called slag when you weld. And if you look at the actual fingerprint, okay, and do the chemical analysis of these slag samples, you find that those slag samples aren't really steel, okay? Now, if you cut that thing with an oxyacetylene torch, you would expect the chemical composition to stay the same, okay? But what was actually found is you've seen an order of magnitude less chromium, an order of magnitude less nickel, a large amount of manganese, okay? And a complete order of magnitude amount, a larger amount of aluminum in the slag samples compared to the steel. You also find trace amounts of potassium, sulfur, and barium, okay? Now, the reason this is important is if you had an aluminothermic reaction, like from a thermite reaction, where you use aluminum powder plus some kind of oxide. Excuse me?
We have a dentist on line one?
I'm sorry, I can't understand.
Oh, sorry. We have a dentist on line one?
Okay.
I'll put him on.
Okay, we have another guest, I believe. Are you there? Yes, I'm here. Yeah, welcome to the show. State your first name, where you're from, and your question for our guest.
Okay, my name is Dennis, and actually I'm listening to this program here on Pal Talk here in the room. My question is this. I have seen several times the interviews with Larry Silverstein, who was the leaseholder for the World Trade Center, and how on the program on the PBS publication, he came out and actually said that the fire chiefs and so forth were worried about, you know, the loss of life and so forth, and they decided to pull Building 7. Now, I heard him admit this on the documentary, and with his own mouth and his own words, he said this. But what I'm amazed at is how fast they could have taken Building 7, prepped it to be demolitioned or to be pulled, and had it ready to be pulled down just a few hours after actually the main towers collapsed. I'm talking about within the evening time it was ready to go.
I think you're going to have to
make us believe that if they could prep a building that size, because Building 7 isn't a small building. It was a very large building. If they could prep a building to pull it that evening, that quickly, what's to make us think that they couldn't do the same over a given period of time for the Twin Towers? Because, I mean, you know, it's clearly stated. He admits that it was pulled, and that is a demolition term used to bring down a building. And I'll give you the mic, and I'll go ahead and listen to your response. Thanks.
Well, the truth is they didn't prep it that day. It was already prepped in advance. I don't know if you want to tackle that one, Professor Fetzer.
Sure. I think we're probably in agreement on this. You're absolutely right about the importance of the...
Oh, wait a minute. Get that busy signal again. There we go.
You're absolutely right about the importance of the Silverstein confession, which I think in retrospect he realizes he ought not to have made about the building having been pulled.
I apologize for that busy signal.
That's okay. He said he was talking with an fire commander, and this verbal pause indicates to me that he knew this guy under a different designation, and that he was telling the fire commander there'd been so much death and destruction, perhaps the best thing was to do was to pull it. He said they made the decision to pull and they watched the building come down. Now, the building came down with all of the characteristics of a classic controlled demolition, many of which Greg has described. Dan Rather, Peter Jennings on the scene, explained how it looked just like those resorts and casinos they'd seen destroyed so many times. Now, it's clear that implies that the building was already primed. It was prepped for a demolition. Nobody believes that it was done that day. It had to have been done in advance, but it does raise the question, the same question you raise. Couldn't, if Building 7 was primed for demolition, couldn't 1 and 2 have been primed as well? And I certainly agree there turned out to have been some odd security lapses a couple of weeks before 9/11, where sections of the building were shut down, employees were sent home, security apparatus was turned off, and teams of so-called engineers were being given access to the building. There are other scenarios, however, that would allow for having had access to that building, too, over an even longer period of time. Because it only had about half occupancy, and my understanding is that Larry Silverstein, in a seemingly magnanimous gesture, had invited artists, for example, to take occupancy. And I believe that on the basis of reduced rent rates, they might have moved people around so that you could arrange, you know, to do whatever you needed to do to prime the building. On the other hand, it doesn't look as though that was the totality of preparation. I think there's a fair case to be made for over-determination here in the sense that they wanted to make absolutely sure that the buildings would be destroyed, and they may have used multiple means in order to bring that about. But the fact that the buildings come down in approximately 10 seconds, or better yet, are destroyed because they aren't actually coming down. In the case of the Building 7, you can see all the floors moving at the same time as the building comes down. In the case of the Twin Towers, the buildings are just patiently waiting their turn to be blown to kingdom come, in Morgan Reynolds' memorable phrase. There's an interesting aside, by the way, with regard to Building 7, which is that new archival footage has just been unearthed from the BBC, where a reporter is stating that the building has come down. It was known as the Solomon Brothers building as well. And she's giving this report at 4:57, which is 23 minutes before the building is actually destroyed. Over her left shoulder, you can see Building 7 in the background, which has given rise to quite a scandal here, insofar as it seems to imply that the BBC was following a script and that there was a good deal of complicity between that that giant in the news world and American intelligence agency.
I agree, and we do have a Josh on line one, if you'd like to take it.
Sure. Boy, we've got a lot of callers tonight. Okay, Josh, you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, just tell us where you're from and then state your question.
Okay, my name is Josh, and I'm from Miami, Florida.
All right.
First I have a sort of remark, and then a question to be asked. I've always thought that this may have been an inside job, but I've always pushed it out of my mind. I really did, and I never wanted to believe that.
But
so many things have happened since. Until I don't know, but my question is, if this was an inside job, wouldn't it take many in order to pull it off? And being that it would be many to pull it off, wouldn't it be all but next to impossible to hide it for the truth not to come out? And I'll take my answer off the end. Thank you.
Okay, right, thank you, Josh. I'll answer that.
Sure.
Yes, I mean, it would take, you know, quite a few people to pull it off. But the problem is all the evidence seems to be stacking up that that's exactly why it happened. Now, you know, you look at, you know, as you may be already aware, you look at the Patriot Act was already written and just ready to be rammed through right after 9/11. You look at the amassing of troops to invade Afghanistan, which was happening before 9/11 happened. In fact, I think most people are aware of a man named Alex Jones who kind of has this uncanny skill to monitor kind of the propaganda that's put out. And he went on air, I believe it was a month or two before 9/11 actually occurred. And he was ranting on his TV show where he said, you know, tell them to call into the White House. Please, people in the audience, call into the White House. Tell them to call the attack off. They're going to crash planes in the buildings or blow up planes, and they're going to blame it on their CIA asset, Bin Laden.
You have
several of these things that seem to be lining up. Now, one thing is how many people would it take to actually go in and plant explosives in the building? Well, you know, it depends on over what time period it would take, but I think there's been certain estimates on if you were going to use explosives, you know, per tower, you would need, you know, 20, something on the order of 20 to 40 people to, you know, over the course of maybe several days. I mean, I don't remember the exact numbers, but, I mean, it was something like that.
Mark from Vegas, if you'd like me to put them on?
Yeah, if you could just hold them for one second.
You got it.
You know, it actually doesn't take that many people when you really think about it. All it takes is control of the top high-level positions, not only in government, but in the media. If you've got control over the media heads, and unfortunately you do a little research, you discover that is in fact the case, then that's really all you need to have, because the media will do their job of covering it up and making sure the public doesn't find out what's going on. And when you have control of key government positions at the highest levels, they'll make sure that everyone under their umbrella in their various agencies keeps quiet, too, or they're in the unemployment line. We know this was done with the New York Fire Department, the Police Department. They had gag orders put on them. They weren't allowed to talk. So that shut, you know, virtually all of them up. They were afraid to lose their jobs. It's far more easy to pull something off like this than you care to know. What's that?
You're right, Charles, and a nice illustration of this is that a lot of people involved didn't know they were involved. Webster Tarpley now, in the second edition of his book, has enumerated as many as 15 different war games that were going on, simulations involving airplane crashes and the like, which completely interdicted the normal relationship between the FAA and NORAD. Now, most of those who were participating in those war games had no idea that they were part of an elaborate charade that was intended to confuse and confound those who were trying to figure out what was actually going on that day. So I believe you're completely right. There's, you know, compartmentalization and levels of involvement. At the highest level, they know what they're doing, but they're pushing the bells, pressing the buttons, and others are responding in ways that they're trained to do.
Right. We do have one other caller. I think we'll have enough time to get this in before we go to our next break. So I forgot who the name was, but are you with us? We'll get him a second here. He's got to cue him in.
No, he's there.
Okay. Hello? Are you with us, caller?
Hello?
Yeah, welcome to the show. Just if you would just state your first name and where you're from and then your question.
Yeah. My name is Mark, and I'm calling from Las Vegas. And I know there's been a lot of focus on the World Trade Center, and I know I like to avoid speculation, but I'll tell you from the grainy images that were released of the Pentagon, whatever hit the Pentagon, it sure looked like it was hugging the terrain. And I was thinking, I was wondering, does the guest ever think we'll find out exactly what hit the Pentagon?
Well, I've done a fair amount of work on the Pentagon, and there's lots of evidence that disproves the official account that it was a Boeing 757. You don't have a massive pile of debris, the wings, the fuselage, the seats, the bodies, the luggage, even the tail at the hit point, which is only about 10 feet high and 15 or 16 feet wide on the ground floor. There's no 757 visible in the few videos that have been released. We estimate there are as many as 84, but only three have been released, plus five frames. One of those frames has as much information as you find in all those videos in relation to the plane. Just above a gate mechanism, you can see what appears to be the tail of a plane. If you scale a Boeing 757 to the size of that tail, then it's much more prominent. It would easily have been visible. The plane is 155 feet long, which is more than twice as long as the Pentagon at 77 feet is high. So the fact that you don't see it in the videos is clear proof that it wasn't present, just as if you went into your living room and couldn't find evidence of an elephant as evidence that there was no elephant in your living room. The third line of reasoning that draws the inference that it wasn't a Boeing 757 is that it's aerodynamically impossible for a big plane at that high speed, over 500 miles an hour, to just skim the ground. Aeronautical engineers have explained to me that even our little Cessna at full throttle couldn't get closer than 15 feet to the ground because of a packet of compressed gas which accumulates under the fuselage, and the faster you go, the more there is. That gas, of course, is air. The only way in which planes are able to land is because they slow down as they come in for a landing, and that pocket of compressed gas diminishes in size. They estimate that with a Boeing 757, the plane couldn't get closer than 60 feet to the ground. My own research on this subject suggests it was a much smaller aircraft, and there are a number of others who have arrived at the same conclusion, including A.K. Dewdney, who's a professor from Western Ontario, who's done a fairly extensive study of the damage done to the building, which is consistent with a much smaller aircraft, something akin to maybe an an F-16 or perhaps an A-3 Sky Warrior.
Yeah.
What about the possibility of a Kelkom, air-launched cruise missile?
There's a white plume of smoke beneath this tail behind the gate mechanism. The size of the plane behind the gate mechanism is about half the size of a 757, and that would fit the Sky Warrior, which is 76 feet long, about half the size, and has a tail that only spins up 22 feet, about half the size. The plume of white smoke would be consistent with it firing a missile into the building before it strikes the building itself, which I believe is what happened.
Yeah, I agree with that. Let me stop you right there. We've got to take another break. Come back with us, folks. Stay with us. We'll be back with Professor Greg Jenkins and Professor James Fetzer. Thank you. Okay, welcome back. Once again, our guests this evening are Dr. Greg Jenkins from Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice and Professor James Fetzer from Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Before we take our next caller, I just wanted to ask Professor Fetzer to respond to something we were talking about earlier. Boy, we're getting so many calls tonight. It's great, but we're kind of getting off on various different tangents here instead of the issue at hand of, you know, what caused the split. And I wanted you to take the opportunity, Professor Fetzer, to comment about the amount of debris being, the missing debris being accounted for, as Professor Jenkins had mentioned, as winding up in the basement of the towers. Do you feel that that would account for the missing debris? And are you comfortable with the idea of the dust being just the cement and not the actual contents of the building?
No. I think it's very clear, and there are lots of studies of the dust that have been done that are vastly more extensive and varied than what Stephen Jones has done. but it appears to include the pulverization of the concrete flooring material, the desks and furnitures, including the computers, the human beings and other living things, as well as, you know, the steel, which was coated with asbestos. I mean, that all went up in a, you know, there's a huge amount of dust and pulverization that's so conspicuous in the photographic record. It really is very difficult to convey the enormity of the evidence here if you aren't looking at the photographic record. And this is a reason why I encourage everyone to go to drjudywood.com to take a look at the evidence, the data that she and Morgan Reynolds have accumulated there, so you begin to appreciate the enormity of what we're trying to explain. Even if thermite were good as gold in relation to the Twin Towers, it wouldn't begin to explain the damage to buildings 3, 4, 5, and 6, which suffered very astonishing kinds of damage, including a number of circular incisions, as it were, from that appear to have come from above, that may be as many as 50 in number. There's a huge gash in WTC-3. There's an enormous scoop out in Building 6. I mean, the material is just all gone. And it, as far as, you know, getting a contrast case, which I think is really brings home the point, this week, because of the interest in the BBC report, there have been a lot of photographs of Building 7 after it collapsed. And as I mentioned earlier, you see here the result of a classic controlled demolition. And the stack of debris from the building is like 5, 6, even 7 floors high for a 47-story building. Now, that suggests that if the North and the South Tower had come down by a similar causal mechanism without some additional source of energy that produces pulverization, then you should have had something at least twice that size, maybe 10 or 12 or 14 stories worth of massive debris. Instead, it's right down to really basically ground level. Now, it's true that you could put a camera at a certain place at a funny angle, which is something that I dare say Greg Jenkins has done in an interview that he did with Judy, which he added to the interview after it was over, which I thought was an exceptionally misleading thing to do. So I just want you to know that there's a nice comparison case that brings home the point that these buildings were really destroyed virtually down to ground level. So while there is a sub-basement debris, it's not anything like what it ought to be if the sort of conventional causal mechanisms that Steve Jones and Greg Jenkins are advocating were, in fact, the whole story.
Right. Okay. Now, to you, Professor Jenkins.
Yeah, I mean, I can respond to that.
First of all,
is Building 7 basically collapsed into its own footprint, okay?
Can I just interject one point? Could you just make it clear that you're not arguing that there wasn't more than thermite or thermite, right? You do believe there were more powerful explosives, again, just not beam weapons or...
I mean, that is definitely not ruled out, okay?
Yeah.
And nobody actually, not even Stephen Jones is advocating that thermite is the only way that those buildings came down. But there is very strong evidence in fingerprints all over the dust sample, and slag, and molten metal, which strongly support the case that at least some thermite was used to bring down the towers as well as building.
Did you want me to bring the caller on?
But on Building 7, it did not collapse into, or Building 7 collapsed into its footprint, but the towers did not, okay? And so if you look at kind of, you know, the buildings were mostly empty space by volume, okay? All skyscrapers are built of, you know, to maximize the empty space per volume. And so if you look at Building 7, I mean, it collapsed down to roughly, from its initial volume, you can crunch it down basically to about 11.5% after it collapsed, okay? And that, you know, I analyzed the rubble pile, and that's the number I come up with. If you do the same thing for the towers, it's true, if they collapse into their footprint, you would have, you know, if they're 110 stories, well, 10% of that's 11 stories tall. But the problem is they're spread out over an area, okay? And they're spread out over an area roughly, you know, I mean, you got to define what you're talking about, but most of the debris was spread out over 6 times the footprint, okay? Which would automatically, divide that 11 or 12 stories by 6, and you get 2 stories worth of debris. Now, you don't see that, but that's because you have a lot of sublevel collapses. And so I don't really understand why there's this misconception that most of the debris seems to be missing from the towers. It's clearly,
let me tell you one of the problems I have.
Collapse match.
Are you two still taking calls? Or because I've had quite a few. Here's one that wants to get on.
Okay, yeah, I guess we have quite a few callers. Why don't we go ahead and take one more call, and then I wanted to ask another question.
Well, we can, if you don't want to take calls for a particular hour, just let me know.
Oh, no, absolutely. Okay, let me just throw this question out really quick, and then we'll take the next caller.
Well, you got it.
There. Okay, let me just ask you, Professor Jenkins, one of the problems I've had as far as missing debris is the fact that, I mean, you know, we're talking about 110 stories for each building, and each one of those 110 stories must have had at least, what would you say, 2-3 bathrooms? I don't even know how many bathrooms, but there had to be several bathrooms on each floor. We're talking about, you know, dozens and dozens of sinks and toilets and urinals, you know. You don't see any of this. Of course, a lot of the, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's actually a good point. Now, one thing you can do, and I actually put up some links for this interview at 911truthsquad.com. And if you go to that website, I actually put up quite a few links, and I believe the website that it links to is studyof911.com or studiesof911. I forget exactly. But if you just go to that link, you can see that I posted a bunch of pictures from this other website, pointers to this other website, to show the debris pile of Building 7. And they start digging into it, you know, and you don't see large chunks of concrete, even from the Building 7, which everybody agrees that, you know, was basically a classical demolition of some kind, okay? And so you see that there's no large pieces of concrete, you know, the wallboard, you don't see any real pieces of wallboard. They start digging into it, and it just basically looks like mud because they just watered down the whole debris pile. You don't see sinks even in Building 7. You don't see bathtubs. It's all been kind of crushed just from the collapse of the building with the possibility that, you know, they were also pulverized by any kind of explosives that were going off within the building. So it's not surprising that buildings that were, you know, 5 times potential energy larger than the WTC-7 would crush, you know, sinks
right. And
bathtubs and, yeah. You know, wires
you mentioned
and all this
super
stuff.
Thermate on the phone the other day, something I'm not particularly familiar with. That's beyond thermate. What do they add to that to give it that designation? And is that, in fact, a very highly powerful explosive?
Right, that's a good question. No, thermite is not necessarily, thermite or thermate is not necessarily
an explosive. Right.
What you do to make it explosive, though, is you have finer powder aluminum. What that does is it increases the surface area in which aluminum can actually, you know, the chemical reaction of actually burning the aluminum. You know, so by what I'm trying to say is as you decrease the particle size of the aluminum powder in which you make thermate or thermite out of, as you increase that surface area, it does become explosive when you get it to small enough because the reaction then becomes more violent, okay? And so what the difference between thermite and thermate is the only difference there is that you have the addition of sulfur, which is Dr. Fetcher had said earlier in the show that basically just lowers the melting point of steel from 1,500 degrees down to in the area of 600 degrees Celsius.
Okay, so real quick, so we don't keep our poor caller waiting. So do you think that the thermate with the added aluminum, do you think that would suffice to explain the jettison of the huge beams, you know, hundreds of feet horizontally?
Sure. It's just what it is, it's a matter of calculating. I don't think anybody's done this yet. You know, what degree of pulverization did you actually have? Like, what percentage of concrete was actually pulverized? Therefore, what kind of energy does that take? Therefore, what kind of explosives would that take above and beyond the potential energy of the building? Okay. Now, if you kind of did a thought experiment where you drop one half of the building on top of the other half of the building, you know, you would get a lot of dust generated just by the pulverization of the concrete and the wallboard and all this stuff. And in fact, you see that in other controlled demolitions when you see any kind of large structure, you know, with you know, aligned with RDX and brought down, you see upon impact with the ground, you know, large amounts of dust generated. So the precise amount of actual explosives actually needed to cause the degree of pulverization that you've seen is something I don't think anybody's ironed out yet.
Charles, if I might add a few words here.
Yeah, if you could make it quick, I want to get to our call.
Yeah, I will.
Sure.
As recently as 27 December of last year, Steve Jones was acknowledging that he did not know that thermite or thermate or super thermate had been used for demolition before. I mean, his sentence was, one cannot rule out the use of thermite or super thermite cutters for the WTC just because it has not been used before for demolition. I think what we're discovering is that really there's a great deal that is unknown about how these buildings were destroyed, but you have to factor in that there were millions of cubic yards of dust that was covering all of Lower Manhattan. If you don't look at the photographic record, you really can't begin to appreciate the enormity of the pulverization that was taking place. So I just encourage anyone who's seriously interested in this, go to 911scholars.org, for example, scroll down to 23 to 25 February, and look at the scholars exchange between me and Steve Jones, because I have, in brief compass, I cover, in a 15-minute presentation, I cover most of the important evidence that has to be explained, which I suggest thermite and thermate cannot account for.
If I could just add one thing there. Lack of evidence is not evidence. So, I mean, if you try to classify something as unknown, that does not make it plausible, okay, by any stretch of the imagination. Now, one thing that is unsure to me, at least, is this quote of millions of cubic yards. I mean, I haven't seen numbers, or credible numbers, at least, to actually, you know, solidify the argument on exactly how much concrete was pulverized and how much energy that would take. And that's really key to coming to grips with this.
Let me just mention one short point before you.
You guys realize we're going to make you shake hands before the show is over, right?
Can I make just one quick point?
Sure. Okay, then we'll go to our caller.
I mean, I don't know Greg comes up with this fantastic statement about five or, you know, Earth energy sources. I mean, that sounds fantastic. It would only take one atomic bomb to decimate, to completely pulverize those buildings and the whole rest of the World Trade Center. So he's got some weird scale here in coming up with an argument like that that, frankly, is mind-boggling. It seems so preposterous.
Yeah, well, I've got to address that.
I
don't mind.
We can really go back and forth. I tell you what, why don't we hold that thought? We'll come back like we did with the disappearing debris. Let's go over to our apologies here to Brian from Bethesda, who's been waiting patiently for about 20 minutes now. Brian, you're still with us.
Okay. Yeah, I'm still here. Hey, my question is for Dr. Fetzer. And Dr. Fetzer, I'd like to know just exactly what you hope to accomplish by embracing the very points that have been used by the opposition to the 9/11 truth movement to discredit and minimalize the movement. And I find it really suspicious, Dr. Fetzer, that you have no physical evidence to validate your theory, but yet you're willing to try to discredit theories that are based on physical evidence, many of which cannot be argued. And how does your theory explain what happened to Building 7? And I'll go ahead and hang up and listen to your call.
Go ahead, Dr. Fetzer.
Well, we all agree Building 7 was a separate case, so Building 7 doesn't even figure here in this debate. So let's set Building 7 to one side. I spent the whole time of this 15 minutes, if you go to 911scholars.org, go down to 23 to 25 February, and you'll see me laying out evidence after evidence of the effects that were brought about by whatever causes were used here. Now, in science, we're reasoning from causes to effects and from effects back to causes. And we're seeking to determine the probability, if a cause was used, that it would induce or bring about certain class of effects. The effects in this case include the devastation of virtually all and only the buildings of WTC see designation. It includes very weird effects, the gouging out in Building 6, all of these circular kinds of holes that you find in 6 and in 5. It includes the decimation of about one half of Building 4 when the other half remains standing. It includes in Building 3 a huge gouge in Building 3. It includes some 1,400 toasted cars. It includes a massive pulverization that's taking place. I mean, I spend the whole time, the whole 15 minutes, laying out evidence, one sequence after another, and there were about 45 slides during that presentation. So, you know, to draw the inference that there's no evidence is just to not be paying attention. You test hypotheses on the basis of their effects. These hypotheses about lasers, masers, plasmoid, whatever they may have been, are to be tested on the basis of differentiating between their effects. We have plenty of effects there that we have to account for. And they even include, you know, the massive compression of chunks of three or four parts of the floors together. It includes the steel that is warped and bent like spaghetti that appears to have required intense heat. There's a huge amount of evidence available at our disposal. Now, if you're interested in truth, then you have to follow the evidence and logic where it takes you. I am quite convinced that there's no way you can explain this broad and diverse range of effects on the basis of conventional modes of demolition. And therefore, we have to broaden our horizons to the possibility that unconventional modes of demolition were involved here, different ways of delivering concentrated forms of energy, which has been the focus of the Star Wars, the space program to achieve full spectrum dominance. Now, that program has yielded a lot of results, and even preceding it was the HARP program that's capable of delivering 3.6 gigawatts of energy. There's all kinds of stuff out there we don't know a lot about because it's classified. But I can assure you that because of the differential effects that would be brought about by these different types of causes, we can indeed test these hypotheses, confirm some and disconfirm others. So I'm afraid you've been listening too much to position papers being made without reflecting on the logic of the situation. That happens to be my area of expertise as a philosopher of science. So let me assure you, there's nothing untestable or unscientific about looking at unconventional modes of energy, directed energy weapons, which would produce more energy more efficiently than any accumulation of thermite, thermate, RDX, what have you. In fact, that's one of the interesting missing components, it seems to me. Steve Jones has suggested this could all be brought about by 3,000 pounds of RDX in his paper in 9/11, the American Empire. I think that's a very doubtful proposition when you look at the totality of the damage to the World Trade Center. And I only wish that he would satisfy the criterion that we impose upon the NIST of showing us a simulation of the destruction as it would take place according to his hypothesis using thermite and thermate. I would look forward to that.
Dr. Fesser, do you think that we're dealing with some type of beam weapon that wouldn't have left behind any traceable radioactivity?
You're asking me, Charles?
Yeah.
No traceable radioactivity? Well, I don't know about the class of radioactive effects. I mean, lasers, masers, and plasmoids, to the best of my knowledge, don't have radioactive effects. Now, of course, if it was a fusion bomb versus a fission bomb, you get different kinds of effects. And I've been kind of troubled by the eagerness with which some of those on the other side want to, you know, erase consideration of whole families of weapons by talking about one special case within each category. I think we have to be more broad-minded and not allow a lack of imagination about the way in which this might have been done to curtail our understanding of the logical space of possibilities.
Okay, so given that scenario, then, is unfortunately, if it doesn't leave any traceable remnants of radioactivity, there's probably no way of ever actually being able to prove it.
No, Charles, you weren't listening to me. There are all these different kinds of effects. You got the gouge in Building 3, you got the half of Building 4 disappeared, you got the circular holes that are all over the place,
the damage
you got
evidence.
The huge
scoop-out
feature. You're going to have a causal mechanism that can bring about all these effects, not to mention the pulverization of a staggering amount of concrete and metal and furniture and human beings and other living things. I mean, you got a lot to account for.
Right. No, I understand your point, and I agree that we're dealing with a heck of a lot of devastation here that can't be accounted for, you know, with what we know to be conventional weapons, but at the same time, conventional explosives, I should say.
But at the same time, it doesn't look likely. This is, the skeptical viewpoint. It doesn't look likely that we're going to actually, beyond the damage itself, find any physical traceable evidence of such a weapon.
Well, no, you're misunderstanding, Charles. You're looking for the kinds of effects that would be brought about by certain classes of weapons. I mean, suppose it had been done by a nuke, for example. Well, you'd establish that by looking for effects of a nuke and comparing it to other cases of effects of nukes.
Right.
By replication, now, in this case, the fact that right now we don't have access to some of these weapons, which are highly classified, which the government hasn't even acknowledged the existence of, doesn't mean that we won't at some future state in time.
Right.
I mean, I believe that it's, given time and resources, we're going to be able to sort out exactly how this was done, but it's not something that can be rushed, and I'm very bothered by the eagerness that some seem to have to move this into a court of law, because if we're correct that thermite can't begin to explain it, and if it's also true that thermite and other conventional explosives are easily available by eBay, for example, and other common sources, it doesn't point distinctively in the direction of the government, even if it was used.
Right.
That's not an argument to reject conventional explosives that it possibly can't be tracked to the perpetrators. I mean, that's just absurd on the face of it.
No, it explains
now,
the importance
hold on,
of why
hold
if non-conventional weapons
the
are
damage,
used, it's important.
The damage to Building 3, 4, and 6, and the gouge in Building 3 have already been shown that it's perfectly plausible that raining debris from the towers caused that. Tony Zimbardi came out with a paper to where he analyzed the impulse damage expected from large beams impacting, say, Building 6, what would be expected there.
Charles, this is just...
He shows that.
This is so much smoke and mirrors.
You can go to the Journal of 9/11 Studies and check out these papers to where it's clear that the gouge in Building 3, I mean, there's a before and after picture of a huge chunk of debris about to slam into to the 22-story building number 3. And Tony Zimbardi has it in his paper, if I remember correctly. And, he analyzes what kind of impulse damage would you expect, in Building 3 associated with this huge piece of debris about to smash into it. And it's perfectly consistent. There's no problems. Now, as far as these cylindrical holes, there are they were by no means perfectly cylindrical. Okay, and if you look around at Building 5 and Building 4 and Building 6, I mean, you see that, the falling debris reached that area, okay? So it's perfectly plausible that the surrounding buildings were damaged by debris falling from the towers, okay? There's no problem with it. As far as mini nukes goes, Stephen Jones is a nuclear physicist. He came out with a letter. It's a letter A, again, at the Journal of 9/11 Studies, where he rips this to shreds, okay? I mean, I don't know how else to put it. I mean, there were no elevated levels of tritium that you would expect from a new thermonuclear weapon.
There was no
elevated level of iodine-131, which you would expect from a trigger.
Professor Fetzer, what do you say to that?
I say that there are all kinds of different weapons out there with all kinds of different effects, and what has happened here is the sort of thing that Greg Jenkins specializes in, give a very precise version of one special hypothesis and demand exact answers, and if you don't get them, then reject the whole class of hypotheses. I'll tell you what he's saying is a lot of smoke and mirrors. The effects from the falling debris from those buildings would be expected to be random. The effects I'm talking about are decidedly non-random. Just go to 911scholars.org, scroll down to 23 to 25 February, take a look at the evidence I lay out in my exchange with Steve Jones, and you begin to appreciate how far from the mark are his answers to questions that he cannot resolve.
Let me ask you this, Professor Jenkins. Would you agree that the government does have technology that the public is not privy to? I mean, that this is...
Right, but see, here's the deal. Is anything that the government does and comes out with has to obey the laws of physics, all right? So it's not like the government has some special little
secret physics program, and there, you know, it doesn't right. work like that. You have to, I mean, the physics is physics. You got to obey the laws of physics. And so in my calculation, I show that there's no way. Just look at the energy scale associated with vaporizing steel, any appreciable amount of steel in the towers. Okay, by any method, it's a very general argument. I mean, you could shoot, you know, plasmoids at it. You could shoot, you know, ion beams. You can shoot masers and lasers. I mean, you can shoot all this stuff at it, but what you're talking about is vaporizing steel.
We have a couple callers.
That energy, okay, and calculating that energy on the amount of necessary to vaporize steel is absurdly large. In fact, it's so large that it squarely places these arguments in the realm of the impossible, just based on sophomoric physics.
Less political. I'd like to, if I'm calling from the Power Talk room, my name is Grobeck. I want to find out, do you guys, including Allergy Jones, the professor, the doctor, do you guys have anybody, I'm talking any names at all from Congress that are on your side? Anybody, I don't care if they're Democrat, Republican, or Martian. Is there anybody in Congress, whether it's from the House or the Senate, yes, anybody on your side at all about what you're talking about? Now listen on the air. Thank you.
Well, Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich have both expressed open-mindedness about 9/11. Cynthia McKinney was interested in it, but of course she lost her race for re-election. And I expect others will get involved. We're having some success in breaking through the media insofar as, for example, seven letters to the editor of The Nation appeared in the 5 February issue that enumerated dozens of reasons for disbelieving the government's account, actually proves that it's false. But it would be nice if we had a whole line of politicians. I mean, these guys, if they don't have the courage to stand up against an illegal and immoral war in Iraq and Iran, you know, we're not going to expect to see the line forming very fast for 9/11 truth.
My point exactly. I mean, most of our politicians, it should be just common knowledge at this point, sellouts to the big corporations. That
have the backbone of a rubber band.
Yeah, right. Now, I wasn't sure if he was asking if each one of you had backing in your different camps, or if he just meant backing with the whole concept.
Oh, I'm sure he just meant in general. This other is more like inside baseball.
Yeah. I mean, if you're looking for politicians to back the truth about anything, you're wasting your time. But, I mean, there are a few, like you mentioned, but they are the exception, not the rule.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, I guess we have another caller.
Okay, I'll put him on the air.
All right. Are you there, caller?
Hello?
Yeah. Welcome to the show. State your name and your first name and where you're from and then your question.
Yeah, my name is Ken. I'm from New York. So I have a question. I was wanted to comment on the Pentagon situation.
Sure.
You know, I was in D.C. attending a computer training course. I'm in the IT field, and the building I was in just happened to overlook. There's a freeway that runs right between the Pentagon, and then there's some office buildings on the other side of the freeway, and we had heard about when all the rumors were flying about the World Trade Center, and everybody was trying to get online. At that time, they said that the Capitol building had been hit, and we were all trying to figure out what was going on. And you know, the window was open, and I was facing the freeway. wasn't really focused on the Pentagon, but I didn't. You know, I heard the theories about a plane. I didn't see anything.
I didn't see anything.
Well, you know, much less a 737 or a 747 or a 757 aircraft. I didn't see any planes at all. And I can remember seeing the explosion, and then they letting everybody out of class, and everybody jumped on the freeway, and I went to Alexandria to my hotel. But in the days after 9/11, I was in D.C. for about 4 days after that. I've passed by that place, the Pentagon, about 10 times and never saw any debris that would appear to be from a plane. Not a tail section, not a wing section, no seating
areas.
Did
you hear anything? Did you hear any noise like a plane coming in, any loud rumble?
No. The only thing I heard was the boom and the shockwave from that shaking, vibrating the glass across the street.
You didn't happen to notice any lamppost, did you, that might have been knocked down somehow?
I didn't see any lampposts.
Yeah, everything was
normal to
you. I
didn't see any knocked down lampposts at all.
This is very extremely interesting. I'm very glad you called.
I was wondering where they got the people from that were making the accounts of being covered in jet fuel and all that. I've heard some witness accounts of that.
Well, let me just tell you, there was a Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kawatowski who was actually stationed in the Pentagon, and when all this happened, she said they didn't hear any impact with the building. There was an enormous fireball, and she actually walked out outside and looked around and couldn't see any debris whatsoever from any aircraft, and she found the whole thing very strange and puzzling.
Yeah.
So you're not alone. You're not alone in your testimony. We have others very much like it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for calling. Yeah, very, very interesting. It's always good to hear an actual eyewitness that was there and saw or heard. That was a common thing stated by people that were on the scene there, that they didn't hear a loud rumble. Yeah, they didn't hear a loud rumble as though it was a commercial airliner. They heard more of a whistling sound, like, from a missile or a military plane.
Or just an explosion, as you were saying.
Yeah, yeah.
The eyewitnesses seem to be, like, all over the map. I can't make heads or tails out of the Pentagon, to tell you the truth. I mean, the DOD won't release the video evidence, for instance. The videos they put out are security cameras where there's all kinds of inconsistencies associated with the frame. I mean, you're talking about the most paranoid guys probably on the face of the planet, and they're going to release information to the public. Well, I don't know what to think. I mean, there's a couple of things to weigh in here. Hoffman has done an analysis on the Pentagon to where he actually seems to think that it was a plane that hit. Now, I don't know what to think about that. I mean, I got to be up front. I don't know what to think about
we
that.
We have
but,
a
757.
My feeling is that man, there's just not enough data to figure out what happened there.
Well, we know what didn't happen.
Yeah. Right.
We have a Jim online. He's a friend.
Okay.
All right.
I just want to ask you guys, the method of bringing down the towers, the point of contention there, is that the only point of contention? Is there anything else significant, like about the Pentagon, about Flight 93's fate? Is it essentially just that issue that you guys have had the differences?
It's an issue on methodology, I would say. All right. And so, again, I mean, the reason you had this exodus away from scholars and exodus into Scholars for Truth and Justice was kind of the not rigorous approach that Spencer was advocating. You can discuss all kinds of things, but when you advocate things in public, it becomes a problem when they're not well founded.
Let me respond to that, Charles.
Yeah, okay.
I haven't spent 35 years teaching logic, critical thinking, scientific reasoning, published 30 books to put up with this kind of nonsense from a guy like this. I'm very rigorous and demanding, and the fact of the matter is there was no mass exodus. They seized control of the email list, which was a completely corrupt act. They faked the names of the membership administrator and pretended as though it was an official society communication when it was not. They only received feedback back from about 25%. So he's exaggerating all of this from the top to the bottom. This is a guy who has been so unscrupulous that he took a quotation of my own where I was explaining why when he did Judy Wood with an ambush Bush interview at the National Press Club, she couldn't give exact answers to overly specific hypotheses that he was posing because she hasn't herself settled on a specific hypothesis.
Right, yes.
He edited my sentence, this guy did. This is completely dishonest. The science requires a high degree of honesty. I don't find that in this man.
Stop placing wagers here.
I welcome that.
I tell you what, on that happy note, we actually do have another caller come in. Why don't we step back here and take a deep breath? Caller, are you there? We'll give a moment for him to cue in. Don, you got him going? Don't tell me we lost the studio. Jim and Greg, you're still there, right?
yeah, and I can go ahead and address what...
Okay, while they're working on that, go ahead.
You know, I would encourage the listening audience to go and check out the interview that Jim just referenced. It's on video.google.com. If you just do a search for Dr. Greg Jenkins interviews Dr. Judy Wood, you will find it. And, you know, in that interview, I do ask for an exactitude of answers, okay? And the reason I do that is because I am a scientist, which Fetcher is not. And so, of course, I would expect an exactitude of answer. What kind of energies do these things take? I was just asking very sophomoric, basic questions to her. And I encourage the listeners to go and listen to that because this is a woman that is actually promulgating the hypothesis that space beings brought down the towers, which I show in my paper is just a ridiculous notion.
There's something ridiculous going on here, but it isn't Judy Wood's work.
Yeah, it sure is Judy Wood's work. That I would definitely climb the
tree.
Okay, wait, hold on. I think we have our caller. Is that Tony?
Yeah, it's Tony.
Hey, it's our friend Tony.
You know, Greg, you need to relax. Because you people don't know how to cite to someone else's authority. And when they put up good stuff for people to analyze, your own stuff doesn't hold up to the evidence. Everything's based upon Jones and what Jones says. And this big split doesn't need to be happening. You say 80% of the people don't want to be with Fetzer? Why don't you name them? Who are these 80%? Who are these great numbers that are against Jim Fetzer? You know, who are these people? Where do you come from?
You all start out, we're buddies, over 300 of you.
And then once Jim allows some other stuff to come in to be examined, none of you want to be a part of it. And all you want to do is slander Jim Fetzer this, Jim Fetzer that, Jim Fetzer this, Jim Fetzer that. Give me a break. I'm just an outsider looking in, and I'm telling you, you guys look like the foolish ones, and Jim looks like the ones that are being persecuted.
Okay, let's allow them both to respond. I guess, Professor Fetzer, you want to comment on that?
Well, I appreciate that, Tony. I mean, this Greg Jenkins sprung an ambush interview on Judy. It was very unfair. I told him at the time I thought it was very unfair. He was asking for very exact measurements about the amount of energy as though you asked for the wavelength of the energy weapons that brought about these effects. The fact is the effects were brought about. There had to be some amount of energy that did it. No conventional mode of explanation can account for it. As soon as I began to broaden the range of hypotheses under consideration, Steve Jones and his friends started peeing in their pants and decided they had to do their own thing their own way. Well, that's fine. I'm glad they're doing their own thing their own way. But why they should feel they should try to damage scholars is beyond me. We are just as rigorous as any scientific operation in the world. I have a PhD in the history of science and the philosophy of science. And this, I can't allow this guy, who's an imposer, an imposter, in my opinion, in many ways, to make these false claims. Judy Wood is the most highly qualified expert on technical aspects of the World Trade Center in the 9/11 research community. She has degrees in civil engineering and engineering mechanics and materials engineering science. And what she has been doing is not making a premature commitment to one hypothesis or another, but just explaining the hard data, the evidence. Go to Dr. Judy Wood and look at it for yourself. Don't listen to what you're hearing from this guy here. It's a gross distortion.
Okay, I want to give
Professor Jenkins the chance to give a rebuttal. But before that, I just want to remind our listeners.
Hold on one second.
I just want to remind our listeners that both of these gentlemen actually do agree, once again, on the bigger picture, that the towers were taken down. I think we need to remind ourselves of that. You know, we have the same problem here on Pal Talk. You know, we have those who have disagreements on certain issues. But the thing I always like to point out is when we're in the trenches fighting together, a common enemy, you know, I try as best I can to remain allies with people that are still on the same side. I mean, you guys are on the same side, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, the problem, Charles, is there is not, you know, the big tent approach. I mean, there is not a tent big enough to cover these unsubstantiated claims that Fetcher just constantly promulgates. I mean, it's insane. And so let me just address some of the issues he brought up. So he calls this an ambush interview. I mean, Judy Wood did graciously accept an interview at the National Press Club. Okay, to where she clipped on a microphone, sat down in front of two cameras, you know, I mean, what do you mean ambush interview? And then all I did is ask her questions regarding her own research. Now, the problem is she couldn't answer any of those questions, all right? And it was an embarrassment, okay? It wasn't an embarrassment to me, I'll tell you that. It was an embarrassment to her because she couldn't even address the most basic questions. And again, I would like to just say, you know, I mean, don't take my word for it. Go and just look at the video. I mean, it's I think the runtime is like 35 minutes. Go to video.google.com and check the interview.
Charles,
okay, now as far
it
as
was, it was an ambush interview. It wasn't set
it
up in advance. He hit her with it after
it
the
was,
meeting. After I made
okay, well, hold on. Just let him finish, and then I'll give you the.
Man. It was not an ambush interview.
Look, he was making questions that had all sorts of presuppositions. He was talking about the collapse of the towers. When the towers didn't collapse, they were pulverized. He was talking about vaporization of the steel. When we were talking about dustification or pulverization of the steel, he was putting words in her mouth. She wasn't accepting it. He, therefore, was able to make her look a little funny because she wasn't buying what he was saying. That's what's going on here. It was a very cleverly done hit job. It was nasty. It was unfair. And I'm here to say I was there when it happened, and I told him afterwards it was grossly unfair. I told him then, I tell him now.
Well, you know, I was there too, and you can't just go around making up words like dustification. In fact, I asked her in the interview if she knew of any method on which to dustify steel, and there is no method. She said, oh, possibly microwaves. Well, I'm here to tell you. I'm here to tell you, man, that microwaves are reflected off of metal.
Plasma, tens of thousands of degrees can bring about molecular dissociation, which appears to be the general phenomenon that we find present at the World Trade Center.
Yeah, and Greg,
listen, we've got enough.
Where is the iron in the air?
We got enough of your nonsense for one night, Craig. Let's answer questions from...
Okay, guys, we actually have another caller. Let's take a breath again. And
nonsense, all right.
Okay, we do have another caller. Are you there, caller?
Okay.
You there?
Hello?
Yeah, welcome to the show. If you could just give your first name, where you're from, and then your question for our guest.
Yes, my name is Mike. I'm from Fort Worth, Texas. I was in New York City on 9/11. I was in an apartment in Brooklyn, New York with my mother, and it was horrible. I am an avid questioner of 9/11. I host the show 9/11 Reveal Thursday 7 to 9 Central on Pal Talk Messenger. What my question is this, is that after the 9/11 Commission and the report and the stonewalling, where's the true investigation? Because I don't see a real true investigation into the attacks of that tragic day. Why isn't this administration being criminally prosecuted for letting their own citizens come under attack?
I think that's a great point, and that criminal negligence is a basis on which this administration could be prosecuted, and we have a lot of evidence thereof. Many of the books I've cited, but others like Webster Carpley's 9/11 Synthetic Terror, lay out quite a substantial case. So does Michael Rupert's Crossing the Rubicon,
establishes an enormous circumstantial case based on witness testimony that Dick Cheney was the key player and orchestrator of the 9/11 execution of the 9/11 attack. But others who appear to have been involved include Donald Rumsfeld, Donald Fife, Paul Wolfowitz, General Richard Meyer, Condoleezza Rice, Rudy Giuliani, and Larry Silverstein. They appear to be the core, the nucleus that was responsible for these events on 9/11.
Yeah, absolutely. We're dealing, of course, with far more than just negligence. I mean, there's complicity on a grand scale here.
There's no way it couldn't be complicit. I mean, even you take Norman Mineta's testimony, and you see that, you know, in the command bunker, you know, Dick Cheney is ordering, basically ordering the stand down to not protect the Pentagon. And so, I mean, there's just so many fronts to where you actually could call for a criminal investigation. Now, I mean, we're all trying our best on different fronts to bring that about, but, man, it's an uphill battle.
You know, I just want to ask Don back in the studio. I understand we are going through 10:30. Is that still the case because of starting late?
Yes.
Is that okay with you, James and Greg?
Sure.
Yes, we
are.
Yeah,
I'll stay.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
So,
for another 40 minutes or so.
Yeah, another 40 minutes. Okay, let me just remind our listeners, anybody who wants to call in the U.S., you can reach us toll-free at 877-270-8714. Again, that's 877-270-8714. Outside the U.S., 530-413-4515 or 530-413-4511. Okay. I'm trying to think where we can go without getting into contention. Can be a good thing sometimes. But
can you get any questions out of the pal talk?
Yeah, that's true. Maybe if somebody wants to type in. In the meantime, I just wanted to say, you know what I see that's most unfortunate about the split here, the disagreement, whatever, is, you know, stuff like this tends to feed into the neocons agenda. You know, they love this. I'm sure you guys have encountered that. They just eat this stuff up. They indulge in it. And I think to a degree they probably instigate it. I mean, they've had decades of experience doing this. You know, back in the Vietnam War days, they would infiltrate protest groups and start rumors or, you know, just they knew how to push buttons. And
Charles, it's really very funny. It doesn't seem to be breaking outside of the 9/11 research community at all. I have yet to see any real coverage of this division, which I think, you know, really is rooted in the fact that we just don't know what happened to the Twin Towers or to the rest of the World Trade Center, and we have to conduct a whole lot more investigation and consider the full range of hypotheses. Let me make a very simple point. Steve Jones and Greg Jenkins can't show that thermite-thermate plus is the best hypothesis unless you can compare it with the alternatives and show it's better than the alternatives. Now, it's true that they are looking selectively at a few, but the fact is you got to look at the full range of the evidence, where it's very difficult for me to see how their preferred hypothesis can possibly explain it. That's my bottom line. If they could explain all the phenomena that trouble me, then I might be more favorably disposed. But so far as I can see, they can't possibly do that. And I give a thumbnail sketch of exactly what I'm talking about in this exchange with Steve that you can find on 911scholars.org by scrolling down to the events for 23-25 February, and you'll find it right there.
We
do have another caller. In just one moment we'll take him. But I just was wondering, has there been any effort, and if not, why, to subpoena the evidence that's still being held in Hangar 17 at Kennedy Airport, JFK Airport in New York?
Scholars has a petition that must now have over 20,000 signatures that is asking for the release of evidence in 12 different categories, Charles. It's right at the top left of the 911scholars.org website, Scholars for 9/11 Truth website, and it's been sent to the Senate and the House now twice. Stephen St. John of New York has actually sent it to every member of the House and every member of the Senate two different times to let them know what we're missing. But, yes, there's a huge amount of evidence that's being withheld from the government,
And if you want to follow up, you know, obvious indications of governmental complicity, the fact that they're withholding this massive amount of evidence across the board is a very telling.
Sure. I mean, the famous meteorite where you have metal just melted and fused together, that would be something interesting to get your hands on. But, of course,
that would be very interesting to do a chemical analysis on, just to see what, first of all, I mean, just by doing an analysis on that, you can see what temperature it has reached. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, in the FEMA report in Appendix C, you see a basically a beam where most of the meat of that beam has kind of been eaten away to where it becomes paper thin under a highly, it's strange, it's under a high temperature, okay, to where this actually occurred. I mean, you can look at the microstructure of the actual metal and see that you actually had what's called annealing processes going on, okay, and they estimated something on the order of 1,000 degrees C that beam had to be at in order for the grain sizes to basically melt. Okay, so you had this what's called intergranular melting, okay, and it was also infused with a lot of sulfur, and so there was some, it's just a very strange phenomenon, and this phenomenon was found at the base of one of the towers by FEMA, at the base of one of the towers and in Building 7, okay, and so you had these huge temperatures in the bases of these buildings.
Sure.
And you know, I think the New York Times had said something to the effect that wow, you know, this sulfidization reaction that has happened to these beams is like one of the biggest mysteries yet to be solved about 9/11.
FEMA's report in Appendix C said that as well, that they can't account for the presence of sulfur, which caused outright corrosion and vaporization of some of the steel. They admitted too. Anyway, I want to take another caller here real quick before we go to our next break. Well, I can take a moment to get him up in the queue here. Quite a few callers tonight. This is good. By the way, we have 146 as of right now.
Yeah, they are on the air.
Okay, yeah, welcome. Please take your first name, where you're from, and your question.
My name is Sammy, and I'm from Dallas, Texas. I've been researching this whole conspiracy for about 2 years now, and I was a sophomore in high school when I started researching it, and I find it so amazing that I hear two professors talking about the truth, and then they argue with each other. And when I went to school, I would always argue about 9/11, and I would just say exactly what your guys are saying about the steel and the hard facts. And the point is what I would like to make here is that this is, if you see how botched the operation is, it was a psychological operation to get the people who would be looking for the truth to argue about the truth on the misconceptions, okay? Now, what I wanted to ask is, because they are trying to groom a reaction out of us, and the intellectual community is harboring around false and misinformation, that what they've done is they've made it to where we're going to have to choose, like you said, Congressman Ron Paul, or one of the third-party groups. Now, what I want to ask your professors is, do you think that after their next stage terror attack, that we will have the choice to choose, or will our leader be chosen for us?
Well,
and if our leader will be chosen for us, where does that leave our fight for truth? Where are we going to have to take this fight for truth?
We haven't actually had a choice the past two elections, to be honest with you.
Well, I think you're an astute young man, and I like your questions and observations. I mean, look, one thing you got to appreciate out of the strenuousness of our argument is we are trying to figure out what is the truth. You know, I mean, that is the central desideratum here. And if we're approaching it in different ways, there's a possible mode of reconciliation, which would be to say thermite is part of the answer, but I insist that it isn't the whole answer. And what we hear from the other side is they agree that it isn't the whole answer, but the rest of the answer can't possibly be one of these non-conventional weapons that can deliver more energy more efficiently than any conventional weapon. So I find that very puzzling and indefensible from a logical point of view. Now, I believe if there is another terrorist attack,
attack, a fake terrorist attack, which we all fear, the probability will be that the Constitution will be suspended and that we will be placed under military law and that George Bush will reign as the dictator of the United States. That's my great fear and apprehension, and I'm very confident that Greg and Charles and everyone else listening here shares that concern. So let us hope that doesn't happen. But it also reflects why it's so terribly important to get the truth about 9/11 out to the American people so they will begin to appreciate exactly where we stand vis-a-vis this rogue administration.
Well, as I'm sure you're aware, you got the John Warner Military Reform Act or whatever, 2007. That actually allows for Bush now to override Posse Comitatus and the Sedition Act of 1807 and instantly implement martial law.
Has that been passed?
As far as I know, yeah.
That was H.R. 6166.
We do have another caller on, plus
right.
We have this caller on. Do you want me to keep this caller on and put on the other one? Or?
So can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Okay, well, you know what? Can you hold on? It's actually the top of the hour here. I guess we need to take one more break, and then we'll have another half hour on the other side. So why don't we do that at this time? Please stay with us. We'll be back with our guests, James Fetzer and Greg Jenkins. Okay, I think we're back. Welcome everyone back. We are on again with our guests, James Fetzer and Greg Jenkins, talking about the collapse of the towers primarily and what brought this about. I believe we still have the caller on the line, or did he?
Sammy, yeah.
Yeah, you said you had another question.
Sammy hung up.
Oh, I guess
that might be him back.
Okay, well, while we're waiting for that, we got a question in the type chat here. A friend of ours, Haley Eyes, she goes by the name of, and she was just wondering, do they have any photographs of the people who perished in the plane? I imagine she's referring to any of the four photographs of their remains.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, there's so many mysteries about the planes. Two of those aircraft were not deregistered until the year 2002. The other two were not deregistered until 2005. That's
right.
Very peculiar.
Very.
There are innumerable oddities about the aircraft. I even believe that substitutes were made and that the planes that hit the towers were not 767s, but militarized versions, possibly used as jet refueling tankers so that they could have a larger fireball. And my suspicion would be those planes, like whatever hit the Pentagon, were under remote control. Flight 93 is a complete mystery all by itself, and there's so many oddities there that it's very difficult to sort out what went on. A plane might have been shot out of the sky there. The debris is scattered over about 8 square miles, but it's not. In none of these cases do you have the kinds of components of time-sensitive, safety-related components of the aircraft, of which there are literally hundreds. In none of those four cases has a single one of those time-sensitive, uniquely identifiable components been produced.
Yeah. And, you know, the truth is, even if they produced pictures at this point, I mean, they've had plenty of time to play with their photos.
Sure. How would you know where the body was and whose body it was,
sure,
and under what circumstances?
Exactly. Okay. Did you have any comments you wanted to add to Professor Jenkins?
Well, yeah. I mean, the coroner that showed up to the Pennsylvania Shanksville crash basically is quoted as saying that he stopped being coroner after about, and I forget the number of minutes, but it was like 10 minutes. Because there weren't hardly any body parts, okay? And what can you say? Same thing at the World Trade Center towers. A lot of people were never identified.
Did you hear the comments made by...
Because the bodies were so horribly damaged.
Well,
the comments made by that coroner in Pennsylvania, he was on the BBC documentary a couple
of years
ago.
Yeah, he revised his position, Charles.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Now he says he was misunderstood and misquoted.
What a phony. His statement was very clear. He says, I knew there was no body parts. I knew there was no work for me to do there. And now he's saying, oh, no, what I meant was it was obvious the plane crashed there and there was no need to investigate because we knew what happened. That's not what he said.
Yeah, it's strange that he backtracked. I mean, it's puzzling to say the very
As a principle of investigation, Charles, the earlier reports or the earlier witness testimony tend to be more reliable than the later. They've had more time to think about it, more pressure brought on them, more reason to change their mind, lose their memory, what have you. Actually, at the World Trade Center, we have some 1,100 bodies that were never recovered in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I'm sure that they were nudged along to help them lose their memory. Look at Jamie McIntyre from CNN. He's the one who said, you know, the
no evidence of any plane hitting here, no fuselage, no wing section, tail section. And then last year when the two videos were released in May, he says, I was there. I took pictures. There was tons of debris all over the place. I mean, it's unbelievable.
It is. It is. Unbelievable is literally true.
I mean, these people are just bold-faced liars.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway,
than our highest elected officials.
Right, right. Yeah, it just runs downhill, as they say, you know, when you see the lies emanating to such an extensive degree from the highest levels of government. It's only natural. It's, you know, we deal a lot with that here on Pal Talk. You know, we have a room that pretty much runs 24/7, and you have the neocons that come in, the Bush defenders, you know, and you can tell, for the most part, these people, they're lying. They actually know that 9/11 was an inside job, but they have no conscience. These people are, you know, they use the same lame excuses all the time. You can tell that they don't even believe what they're saying.
Right. I mean, I've actually heard it argued by some people that it's like, all right, maybe it was an inside job, but we need the oil. So,
right, as a last resort.
You know, it's like, what do you mean? I mean, you have to be a moral human being, you know, to exist. I mean, I don't even know how you could possibly go through life existing like that. It's so amoral.
Right. Charles and Greg and I agree on this point. I mean, even Noam Chomsky has been quoted as saying, even if it was an inside job, who cares? I find that attitude absolutely appalling and despicable.
Yeah, you know, as much as I appreciate some of the things he's written, when it comes to 9/11, he wrote a book, of course, on 9/11, and he doesn't question any of the official story, kind of like Mike Moore's film, you know.
He's equally bad on JFK, Charles. He's terrible on, you know, on all the intermediate issues, he's fantastic, outstanding, a champion. And when it comes to the really big issues, he's a barrier, an obstacle. He suppresses the freedom of inquiry.
We have a caller from London.
Right.
A Cullen from London, if you want me to put him on the air.
Sure, we got a caller coming in from
London. Here they come.
All the way from across the pond, as they say. Getting queued up.
Hello.
Yeah, if you could state your name and your question for our guest. Your first name.
I'm Colin from London. I wanted to say to Jim Fatsa, I don't know if he'd done the Trouble with Stephen Jones. He'd done a website, Trouble with Stephen Jones, with the woman, and they were making some claims.
Was a website
or a website? But I thought towards the end, got really ridiculous, and it's just like David Shaler done. He'd done a program on, I think it was Sky TV in England, which went really well. And at the end, he started talking about holographic planes hitting the towers. And, you know, I think this really is not doing the truth movement no good whatsoever.
Yeah, nobody's advocating.
And, you know, even though I respect Jim Fatsa, I think you want to keep it a reality.
I couldn't agree more. I've actually been very skeptical about anyone who wants to argue that no planes hit the Twin Towers, and I've said so in print. I am interested in why they think that and what line of reasoning could lead to that conclusion. I hold Morgan Reynolds in very high esteem, for example. He's a very accomplished man. He's got a brilliant intellect, and I'm trying to figure out. I'll even be talking with him tomorrow on my own show on Genesis from 3 to 5 about his views about no planes, but it's because I want to, you know, challenge it and find out about it and learn his reasons for holding a view that I think is very difficult to take seriously.
I would have to agree with that. I mean, there was a paper put out in the Journal of 9/11 Studies .org by Eric Salter, which makes a lot of things point by point. This debunks a lot of like kind of the no plane theory. I don't know if it addresses all the issues, but it certainly addresses a lot of them, and it might be helpful to check that article out.
Okay, unfortunately, I missed that last part there. We got the busy.
We have another caller.
Okay, I guess we have another caller.
We'll put him on.
Boy, back to back tonight. Okay, call, are you with us?
Yeah, sure am.
Yeah, if you could give us your first name and where you're from and your question.
Hi, Mike from California. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to both professors for being on the show. And I think both of you are doing your job to try and bring out the truth in your own way. What do you think is going to take this out of the realm of a JFK conspiracy or a Loch Ness monster. I mean, is this going to be another one of those things where 50 years down the line after, you know, Freedom of Information Act documents are released that we might get a glimpse of what really happened? Or
Mike, that's,
you know,
the reason we're working so hard right now. It's the reason we're all motivated to work as hard as we can right now to bring about some kind of criminal investigation, and that criminal investigation would have to be oversight. I mean, we're trying to avoid that, but, you know, we're all kind of, you know, going at it from different angles, and hopefully some of those angles will succeed. I mean, one reason that the Thermate business is kind of put out in the forefront is because it looks like there's some very solid scientific evidence that supports the Thermate hypothesis, and that would bring about a criminal investigation. I mean, by law, if you have an incendiary and fires, well, automatically the laws say that you have to investigate it criminally. And so just by finding trace elements of Thermate in the residues and the melted fuel and the slag, I mean, that is a motivating point to push for a criminal investigation. Now, I mean, one of the goals right now is to still bring in, you know, more people into the movement. And so one of the goals right now of STJ 9/11 is to put out a major publication in, like, you know, a respected scientific journal talking about the evidence built up for this, you know, the body of work that exists right now for Thermate, okay? And hopefully it'll be this year sometime to where we can put all this evidence forward and bring about what's required by law to be a criminal investigation.
Let me just add that I think having two groups that are pursuing these issues is not a bad thing. In the history of science, competition between research groups has proven to be a great benefit, so I'm not really bothered. In fact, I think there is merit to having two groups. My great concern is that we not settle for overly simple answers to complex problems. But if Thermate can pan out and show itself to be a viable contributing factor to this case, obviously that greatly strengthens the evidence that it was an inside job.
Right, and like I said, that's ultimately the bottom line here, is that in the big picture, that there is agreement on both sides. There's no question this was an inside job. There's no question the demolition job did bring the towers down. So that's one thing we've got to keep reminding ourselves of here, and keep in perspective that we're actually on the same side. You know, we're in the trenches fighting together. We got a common enemy. Hopefully we won't focus so much on our differences as we will on our commonalities. So
I think we'd like to see the strongest possible case brought against this administration for its complicity, which is, in my opinion, provable on multiple grounds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Multiple grounds from a variety of different angles. I mean, scientifically, you know, just looking at the forensic evidence is only one approach out of many. I mean, you have all of these circumstantial evidence on, let's go after the people that, you know, why did NORAD stand down? That's never been properly addressed. Why were the put options? What's the deal with the Buzzy Cronkard, you know, company front that put the put options on American Airlines? I mean, so there's a variety of attack points, okay, and we're all just doing our bit on what we're good at, basically.
And the weakness of the 9/11 Commission report is overwhelming, so I really encourage you know, anyone with a serious interest to pick up David Ray Griffin's critique, which is entitled The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions.
Yeah, that's excellent. Very good. And, you know, that's the problem. Nobody has even been so much as reprimanded, never mind being fired. Even if you overlook the whole idea of complicity as far as them carrying out the attacks, just the incompetence that we're looking at here.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking almost 2 hours, four hijacked planes flying around North American airspace,
yes,
around the nation's capital, around New York, and absolutely nothing was ever done to intercept and or shoot down. I mean, to me, that is one of the most ridiculous aspects of this.
Poland Air Force Base is almost right across the river from the Pentagon. You can see the Pentagon from Boland Air Force Base in D.C. I mean, it's absolutely incredible to say that a plane was flying around for an hour and a half when they knew that the planes were hijacked, that it could possibly hit anything, especially the Pentagon, where, you know, again, you have the most paranoid guys on Earth. Furthermore, what about the missile batteries that were supposed to be mounted around the Pentagon? In the 70s, they advertised, like, look, we got all these anti-aircraft, you know, missiles, you know, basically mounted on the Pentagon. Well, I mean, you know, this is 30 years later. I mean, my goodness.
Right.
I mean,
and what's so laughable is these guys have been called master planners. How masterful could they be at planning when they hijack planes up in Boston? 35-40 minute ride away from New York, which allowed plenty of time for an intercept.
Yes.
And then you come to the other two planes, it's even worse. They fly all the way to the eastern border of Ohio, only to turn around, and this is after the two towers had already been hit. What kind of master planning is that?
Those are great points. They should have been hijacking planes from JFK or LaGuardia,
right,
for God's sake, for New York.
Yes.
And maybe Ronald Reagan, you know, to hit the Pentagon. Your plane's impeccable. You know, the NORAD chiefs normally boast about how it only takes 2.5 minutes to get a plane up in the air. But in this case, of course, the whole thing was so miserable, and their reports even to the 9/11 commission were so inconsistent that even Lee Hamilton and Tom Keene, in their book Without Precedent, said that they couldn't understand why they had been lied to by the Pentagon. And I just say, well, if this guy Keene was so naive that he couldn't understand why the Pentagon might want to lie, he might not have been such a great choice to head the commission.
We do have a mic on line one.
Okay, we do have another caller. Wait a moment for him to get queued in.
Am I on the air?
Yeah, if you could just state your name,
okay,
please, and your first name and your question.
Mike, my question is this, and I haven't been listening but for about 10 minutes. There was a theory that cell phones don't work in jetliners, but you could use the Sky phone, I would imagine, in the thing above that. Not that you guys are even saying that. There was a passport, I think, I can't remember his name, that was actually found in pristine condition on the ground. Is that true? And the other question is, and we do know we're dealing with incompetence here in this, I don't know where this conspiracy goes, but I think anybody that doesn't believe in conspiracies should never read Shakespeare. But
right,
nobody.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
You were agreeing.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And but a group that is so incompetent, because I really thought they'd, you know, transfer WMDs to Iraq if they had any sense at all. How could they pull this one off? And that's my confusion on this thing.
Well, you know,
hang up
and
listen to you.
They did try that. They got caught, though.
I'd like to address the cell phone issue. I mean, there was, and I'm sorry, but I forget the man's name that did this, but, I mean, he actually flew a Cessna around
Keith Dudney did this.
Model. Oh, thank you. And he actually, you know, measured, you know, kind of quantitatively, like, well, what's the probability of actually just getting any kind of signal? And above 10,000 feet, the probability is virtually zero. And this plane was supposed to be flying at altitude, right? So it's supposed to be flying at 25 to 30,000 feet.
Right.
Okay. And also, you have a problem with cell phone towers, right? I mean, cell phone towers have a hard enough time switching, okay, from one station to another as you drive your car at 70 or 80 miles an hour, okay? I mean, a lot of times they drop the calls. They're getting a lot better now. But, man, they're not going to be switching towers at 500, 600 miles an hour. You know, so, you know, this whole idea that cell phones were made by, you know, passengers in the plane for 10 minutes at a time, over, you know, upstate Pennsylvania is just ludicrous on the face of it. Also, there's the reason you don't get any cell transmission is because basically the antenna is not made to radiate upward. It's made to radiate out. Okay, it's kind of a physics.
Let me just add on to that. I agree with what Greg has been saying. But there are other oddities involved here. For example, there were some 19 calls made from these various planes. Of those 19 persons who purportedly made those calls, exactly one name appears on the Social Security Death Index. And of all of those 19, the number that whose survivors received any benefit from the fund created for the survivors is zero. There are lots of oddities here about these calls and who was involved.
Well, I love the famous Mark Bingham, you know, hi, Mom, this is Mark Bingham calling. It's ridiculous.
And then when she asks him a question, she gets no answer. The phone cuts out. He can't answer
right.
because it was a computer simulated.
Don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's laughable, you know. And then you get your Todd Beamer phone calls. Just this past summer, Lisa Jefferson, the Verizon operator that supposedly talked to him, admitted in her book that she doesn't, she's not so convinced she talked to him after all. She says, I don't know his voice.
Hmm.
And
this
the wife
guy, this
never...
seems really odd if this guy expects he might die at any moment and he spends 15 or 20 minutes talking on the phone to an operator instead
Total
of trying
stranger.
To reach his wife.
Right. Right. I mean, if he couldn't get his wife, you know, you think he would have tried for his mother, his neighbor, his dog.
Right. Right.
But a total stranger. It's just ridiculous. And as you go through each one of these calls, there's just major problems. Basically, none of them stand up to close scrutiny. I like this one. There was a woman who called her husband shortly after the plane was hijacked, and she described how she just witnessed someone getting murdered in first class. Then about 20 minutes later, just before the plane came down, a guy calls his wife, and he says, oh, I just want to let you know, honey, you probably heard already, but everything's okay. The hijackers are treating us cordially.
Not exactly a consistent story.
It's so ridiculous. Unbelievable. Anyway, I mean, you could just go on forever like this. You know, people say, well...
Let me go on for a moment then.
Sure.
Because, you know, at the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, who in April of last year was being tried for whether he should get the death penalty or life imprisonment for having been involved in 9/11, whereas a year before he had denied he had anything to do with 9/11, but confessed to having been involved in a plot to hit the White House to free the blind sheik who was involved in the attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. They played a tape recording, allegedly from the cockpit voice recorder of the passengers talking about trying to use a drink cart to break down the cabin door. A member of Scholars contacted me and pointed out quite astutely that cockpit voice recordings don't record voices in the passenger compartment.
Exactly.
Also in that recording, you hear the voices of the alleged hijackers saying, Allah Akbar, Allah Akbar, which of course means God is great in Arabic. But another member of Scholars, who happens to be a Muslim, who notified me, he wrote and said, that's not what you're supposed to say if you're a follower of Islam and about to face death. What you should say in Arabic is, there is but one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. So it appears
right.
that whoever was doing the script here for Flight 93 didn't know enough to get it right.
Well, I mean, if the passengers had to ram the cockpit door with the car to open it, how did the hijackers get in? Did they pry it open with their plastic knives?
Good question.
It's laughable. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. It's like, where did they get the tickets, you know? Not only do we not have their names on any passenger manifest, not only could they not fly the planes, we have no evidence they actually gained access. Even then, you had to show your photo ID to get onto a plane, and the government's never even produced their tickets, leading a friend of mine to observe, well, what happened? Did Osama bin Laden charge them to his MasterCard from his cave in Afghanistan?
Right. And
then,
let's not forget the trunk full of it's like a trunk full of smoking guns, right? And you had a flight training manual. You had
they keep adding to that list all the time.
You know, I mean, it's like, what is this? You know, it's just a frenzy of evidence. I mean,
they keep adding to the list of contents in that bag. Just back in April, now they say, oh, we got the names of the passenger of the hijackers from contents in Atta's bag. They supposedly released all the contents, what was in there years ago, and they never mentioned that all the names were in there and the backgrounds and, you know, where they were born.
This was a fabulous interview. But, Charles, I'm going to let you wrap it up. We got another show here starting in about 3 minutes.
Okay. I was actually going to wait another minute or two to do that, but okay, yeah.
Thank
you. Clock ahead of mine.
Oh, yeah. We are a little fast here, I guess, maybe 5 minutes. Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. Okay. We could literally go on forever. In fact, I wish we had more time. There's just so much to talk about. But anyway, I wanted to thank both of our guests, Professor Besser and Professor Jenkins.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate you taking the time out here. Once again, their websites are 911scholars.org and STJ, that's Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, STJ911.org are the two websites. So, again, we want to thank you guys. Thank you to our callers, to our listeners here on Pal Talk, and we look forward maybe to having you on again sometime.
You got it. Thanks very much, Charles.
Okay. Take care.
Did you know that President Bush's No Child Left Behind Act mandates that public high schools turn over private student information to military recruiters or risk losing federal funding? Not only that, but the Pentagon has compiled a database of over 30 million young people up to age 17 for the purpose of military recruitment. You can protect your child from unwanted military recruiting by removing their names off both these lists. Go to www.leavemychildalone.org.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the table, by the relief of the fest, a storm of people, and they stood there hungry, stood there wondering, if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to New York and Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.